Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming to our session today. This session will provide an overview of the ILM report, the Institute of Medicine report, Relieving Pain in America, a blueprint for transforming prevention, care, education, and research. In addition to providing an overview of the report's findings and recommendations, the presentations today will discuss the report's relevance for public health and opportunities for public health interventions to address pain. I am Adrienne Stith-Butler, and I served as the product officer for this report. And I will start by first giving a brief overview of the IOM, the work that we do, and how we do our work, and a background and context for this particular study and the process for completing the report. And we have here with us today two members of the IOM committee, Olivia Carter-Progress and Ursula Wesselman, in reverse order. And they will provide a review of the report and its recommendations for us today. So I'll start with introductions with first Dr. Wesselman. Okay. Ursula Wesselman is on the faculty at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and is a professor of anesthesiology, neurology, and psychology. She previously was on the faculty of the Department of Neurology at the Johns Hopkins Hospital and an attending physician at Johns Hopkins Hospital and a member of the Johns Hopkins Ballstein Pain Treatment Center. Dr. Wesselman's Translational Pain Research Laboratory is focused on the pathophysiological mechanisms of urogenital and visceral pain syndromes in females. Olivia Carter-Progress is an associate professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the University of Maryland, College Park School of Public Health. She was the previous director of the Division of Policy and Data at the Office of Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. She's conducted research on health disparities for three decades in the federal government and has an extensive history of ensuring that the community has a voice in research conducted at the national and local levels. And she lectures on epidemiologic methods, cultural competency, and health disparities. In terms of disclosures, there are no relationships to disclose with regard to commercial interest relevant to this presentation within the past 12 months. So the Institute of Medicine, just for those who might not be familiar with the organization, is an independent nonprofit organization that works outside of the government to provide unbiased and authoritative advice to decision makers and the public. The IOM is the health arm of the National Academy of Sciences, which was chartered under President Abraham Lincoln in 1863. Most of the studies that we do at the IOM are at the request of the federal government, and guided by what we call statements of task, we assemble committees of experts to answer the set of questions that's posed to us. And we set about answering those questions. So on to the subject for today, Relieving Pain in America. A bit of context. In 2010, the healthcare legislation, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, required HHS to enlist the Institute of Medicine in examining pain as a public health problem, and so hence our relevance for you today. Acting through the National Institutes of Health, HHS asked the IOM to assess the state of the science with regard to pain research, care, and education, and to make recommendations to advance the field. The specific statement of task for this project was to specifically review and quantify the public health significance of pain, identify barriers to appropriate pain care and strategies to reduce such barriers, identify demographic groups and special populations, and discuss related research needs, barriers, and opportunities to reduce these barriers. Fourth, to identify and discuss the scientific tools and technologies that are available to address pain. And finally, looking at opportunities for public-private partnerships in the support and conduct of pain research and education. The committee that was assembled for this report was comprised of 19 members with expertise in a variety of areas, and they're listed here for you. I won't read them all, but it was really a very very varied group, most with some expertise in the field of pain, and a couple that were somewhat outside of the area of pain, which we will often do helps to bring some objectivity and perspective to the issues. Methods for the study. The committee reviewed the literature that was related to the statement of task. They commissioned one paper on the economic burden of pain. They found that there was a lot of data missing in this area. The latest, the previous estimates were, I think, Olivia, 10 years old, about 10 years old. So they felt that it would be worthwhile to commission work in this area. The committee also held a series of public workshops. They held four workshops that were focused on a variety of topics to help inform their deliberations in order to address the study charge. And those workshops related to data collection, public-private partnerships, cultural views on pain, the financing and resources for pain care, the basic science of pain, regulation of pain drugs. And finally, each of the workshops, we had an open session for people who were living with pain, their caregivers, and other stakeholders to come and give us their perspectives on the statement of task. The committee put up a survey on the website to gather information from the public on barriers to care, ways to improve care, thoughts on undertreated groups, and also to gather the experiences of those who are seeking care for pain and those who provide care. And it drew over 2,000 responses, so it was quite a rich amount of information that helped to provide context and background for the committee as they deliberate, and also to help to kind of color the report of sorts. Okay. And in thinking about the report and devising the findings and recommendations, the committee really started out with several underlying principles for the report that that help guide the development of recommendations. And those were that first, pain management is a moral imperative. Chronic disease can be a disease in and of itself, which I think Ursula will help address for us. The value of comprehensive treatment, the need for interdisciplinary approaches, and very importantly, the importance of prevention, the wider use of existing knowledge about how to treat pain, and recognizing the conundrum of opioids. It was not a that could be a report in and of itself, but the committee acknowledged that this was a problem that needed to be addressed. Collaborative roles for patients and clinicians, and finally, the value of public health and community-based approaches, which will be a heavy focus of our presentations today. So with that, Ursula, I'll let you thank you.
Yeah, as Adrian mentioned, I'm a neurologist, work out of an anesthesia department in pain management, and I also have a PhD in neurophysiology as it relates to pain, and I hope to give you an overview of pain in the next few minutes and get you excited about this field, and I really encourage you to download the IOM report on pain. I'm going to discuss briefly what is pain, who is at risk, the impact of pain, and the need for transformation. Pain has been defined by the International Association for the Study of Pain, which is a scientific and medical association bringing scientists from all over the world working in the field of pain and healthcare providers together, and we have meetings all over the world every 2 years. So the IASP defined pain in 1994 as the following: an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in terms of such damage. Pain is always subjective. It is unquestionably a sensation in a part or parts of the body, but it is also always unpleasant and therefore also an emotional experience. So this definition tried to put together the mind-body concept, because pain, if it's there, is always unpleasant, and you probably had pain, or for sure had pain in your life, so you can probably associate with this definition. So it's a complicated definition. Pain can be acute, and as I just said, all of you for sure have experienced acute pain. You might have had your thumb in the door of the car, or you might have fallen as a child. Everybody has had acute pain. And this is characterized by sudden onset. It lasts only a short time, and it is linked to specific events, an injury or an illness. So for example, if you have pneumonia, you have chest pain. But then when the pneumonia goes away, the chest pain goes away as well. Chronic pain is defined as pain that lasts more than 3 to 6 months. So different pain syndromes are defined 3 or 6 months. It's changing taxonomies. But importantly, if something lasts longer than 3 months, that's what we also say to as healthcare providers, then the patient should really be evaluated for chronic pain. Chronic pain is difficult to treat. It can result from underlying disease or injury, from medical treatment. A lot of the drugs, for instance, that are currently available for cancer treatment and also for patients with HIV can result in chronic pain syndrome, in painful neuropathies, and it can be due to chronic inflammatory diseases. Or the cause can be unknown, and this often provides a diagnostic difficulty, and some of the patients are then not believed that they actually have pain. And a good example, I think, that is quite obvious to everybody and where there is no doubt, would be headache. So if a patient has headache, nowadays you would do several imaging studies. You might do a CT, you might do an MRI, you might do some vascular studies. And if everything is normal, then obviously the patient doesn't have a brain tumor and the patient doesn't have a vascular malformation, which is in the differential diagnosis for headache. So then it's either a specific headache, such as migraine headache, characterized by very specific clinical symptoms, or a cluster headache, or it goes into this box of undefined headaches. But we would still believe that the patient has a headache. Then with some other pain syndromes, those areas are more taboo, and the patients are often not believed. Examples of that would be pelvic pain, interstitial cystitis, a bladder pain syndrome, vulvodynia, and so on. So for a lot of the chronic pain syndromes, we still don't have diagnostic abilities to assess the pain very well, except for getting the report from the patient that the patient is in pain. Who is at risk? All of us are at risk, including everybody in this room, and it can be from one day to the other. Examples of pain-related conditions for the acute pain are infectious diseases. That plays a role a lot, actually, in the developing countries where infectious diseases are very frequent during all ages. Wound infections, that, for instance, is more prevalent at the moment in the war situation. Dental conditions, you probably have experienced that yourself. Burns, trauma, surgery, childbirth can be very painful if there is no pain relief. It's rated at the same level as amputation of an extremity on the pain scale, and medical procedures. A lot of medical procedures are done in the outpatient setting where there is no adequate pain relief. Chronic pain conditions, to give you some examples, are migraine and other headaches, which I just discussed, arthritis, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, back pain, shingles, sickle cell disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes. So it's a variety of diseases that can result in chronic pain conditions. And risks are affected by many factors such as age, race, sex, income, education, and other demographic factors. To give you an example, Carmen Green published a study this year where she showed that the most significant risk factors for developing pain with cancer is to be black and to be a woman. Pain, if not treated, can have a significant impact. We know from basic science and clinical studies that pain can cause biological changes in the peripheral and central nervous system. So if you have acute pain or initial chronic pain that is not adequately treated, both in the animal experiment as well as in humans, you often see that subsequent painful stimuli or painful events or another inflammatory stimulus can result in additional, more exaggerated pain. And that is why we see a lot of patients who have chronic pain to not only have one pain syndrome, such as migraine headaches, but a lot of comorbidities. So a patient might present with irritable bowel syndrome, fibromyalgia, and migraine headache. And this is not surprising based on the neurophysiology. These changes in chronic pain can be maladaptive and then signal the development of a chronic pain syndrome, which is then even more difficult to treat as if you would have treated the pain to start out with. And consequences can include, which should significantly impair the quality of the life of the patient, reduced mobility, disturbed sleep, immune impairment, a reduced quality of life, fear, anger, depression, anxiety. And you can imagine right away, once these consequences have appeared, how difficult it is for the pain patient. So reduced mobility can result in the fact that the patient can actually not make it by himself or herself to the healthcare provider. Reduced quality of life, that's pretty clear. The patient who has chronic pain usually has a lot of difficulties to enjoy things like the hobbies, the family life, because of the pain. And anger, depression, and anxiety also have effects on the surroundings, on the social surroundings of the pain patient. So the family, the friends, all of that will be impaired by the chronic pain syndrome. So the IOM committee called for a need to implement a cultural transformation. I just want to read you the statements and really encourage you again to download the whole report. Pain is a national challenge. It was really almost depressing as we as a team reviewed all the literature, what a national challenge it is, although we all work in the field of pain, but just seeing the accumulated data which you have in the report really points out what a challenge it is. All people are at risk for pain, and pain is a uniquely individual, subjective experience. Comprehensive and interdisciplinary biopsychosocial approaches are the most important and effective ways to treat pain, and I will later elaborate on that a little bit more. Such care, however, is difficult to obtain at the moment because of structural barriers, including financial and payment disparities, and I will discuss this after Olivia has spoken in more detail. A cultural transformation is needed to better prevent, assess, treat, and understand pain, and the committee's report offers a blueprint for achieving this transformation, and we will discuss a part of that, those recommendations at the end. Now, Olivia.
Thank you. A large reason why we came here to the American Public Health Association is because this is perceived as the go-to organization in terms of public health. So if we're talking about this cultural transformation that's needed to better prevent, assess, treat, and understand pain, we need to get the American Public Health Association, you as members, and also those who are interested in working in the public health workforce, to pay attention to some of these recommendations and hopefully move this forward. So the scope of problem, that was something that we were tasked by Congress to address, and why do we think this really is a public health problem? Seems like it's been mostly in the clinical realm. Well, for one thing, the extent of the problem. We're finding when you do international comparisons, about 37% of all adults in developed countries have chronic pain, and you saw the definition of chronic pain is pain that has been experienced for 3 to 6 months at least. Also, there is a significant cost that's associated with this. It's ubiquitous. It raises societal issues, as you're hearing. There's a need for health professional education. There's new knowledge that we already have that can strengthen what we do right now to reduce the impact of this pain. We have an infrastructure within the public health setting that we can use to develop strategies to prevent chronic pain and to better address it. If you look within Healthy People 2020, we have several objectives that are pertinent. Most of them pertain within the medical product safety session, for instance, increased safe and effective treatment of pain, but it also shows up in reduced disability due to arthritis and reducing non-medical use of prescription drugs. So we were specifically tasked to identify the demographic groups and special populations that were disparately undertreated for pain, as well as come up with economic costs. We used the Medical Expenditure Panel survey to get a cost estimate, and we ramped that up to what we see most recently. And so we have a huge dollar amount that was rather staggering and much higher from the previous estimates that had been seen. So the scope of the problem, as I said, comparisons, international comparisons of developed countries have found about 37% of adults have common chronic pain conditions. When we look with data from the National Center for Statistics, specifically the National Health Interview Survey, we see that adults 18 and over, severe headache or migraine, for instance, 16.1%, neck pain, 15.1%. Some of you may argue with some of these numbers, because certainly if you've been visiting the masseuse upstairs on the third floor or some of the other things that are available in the exhibit area, you may argue, but these are from national data, self-reported information of adults that are reporting pain in the last 3 months. Now, one of the things we found out when we reviewed the data is there's a wealth of data. A lot of it hasn't been analyzed and hasn't been really disseminated. So we really had to dig down to get access to these numbers that we're presenting to you today. The other thing that we found out, there are a lot of caveats. For instance, these are data that are for non-institutionalized populations, civilian non-institutionalized, which means these are individuals who are not in prisons, they're not in the military. Those folks may have higher rates of pain. They also exclude children. As you can see, these are just adults. So major sources of data, in addition to the National Health Interview Survey, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, and the last one is the one we use for our economic analyses. The shortcomings, as I mentioned before, those exclusions, we're only talking about adults with these estimates. Also, it related to only a few conditions. If you had a particular interest, say, for instance, in fibromyalgia, that's been lumped in with other arthritic-related conditions, and so you can't pull out a separate estimate just for fibromyalgia. We also found our national data collection, for instance, the National Health Interview Survey, even though they have standardized questions, they are not using international standards, for instance, for low back pain. If you are interested in that, there are texts, for instance, the Chronic Pain Epidemiology for Oxford University goes into more details, and we cite that text and that reference in our report. So standardization of methods, definitions, and survey questions regarding pain not using international standards, we think we can do a better job simply with our data collection. acute and chronic pain. We're not distinguishing those oftentimes in our available data. So you don't know whether it meets that criteria that we laid out at the very beginning with this operational definition of at least 3 to 6 months of pain. We also don't know about longitudinal consequences of pain. So for instance, we don't know whether there is increased mortality for people who are suffering from chronic pain because National Health Interview Survey, National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, Medical Expenditure Panel Survey are primarily providing a cross-sectional slice of picture of what's going on. And we also are missing a lot of information in what we understand are high-risk populations for chronic pain. We don't have that subgroup data. So what are those high-risk populations? Reviewing the literature, we find that there is evidence for certain populations, our racial and ethnic minority populations, for instance, women, children, the elderly, military veterans, people with cognitive impairments who may have difficulties in even expressing that they're experiencing pain, for instance, somebody with Alzheimer's, surgical patients, cancer patients, people at the end of life, and non-English speakers. So here are data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and all these slides are going to be hopefully posted on the Institute of Medicine's website. We were unable to upload it to the APHA website, but we'll be happy also to make sure you are notified once we do succeed in doing that. It was a problem with the website for APHA. But if you look at adults 20 years and over, the percentage of individuals who reported that they had pain in the previous month, take a look at this. It shows that the percent is increasing over time. The prevalence is increasing over time. From 22.2% during 1999 to 2000, it takes several years to collect enough data that you can give a cost, give a precise estimate. Then in 2001 to 2002, it went up to 25.7%. And then 2003 to 2004, it went up to 27.7%. Unfortunately, we don't have more recent data from NHANES. And again, there's this challenge with the data collection, standardization of questions, so you can look at trends over time. So we went into a very detailed cost analysis using the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. So it's not just getting information about self-report, but it's also linking it to medical records so we can find out who paid for that care, the reason why they went in for the visit, etc. We found very few visits were specifically for pain. It was maybe something else was written on the medical record. But when we looked at the reasons why they went in for their healthcare visit, we found, for instance, people who might have gone in for their arthritis or other issues like that, what we ended up with is having an overall cost estimate, ramping it up to the most recent year of $560 to $635 billion. That's much higher than previous estimates. Previous estimates from the 1990s was approximately $100 billion, and that came out of the National Institutes of Health, but no one that we were able to contact was able to document or explain how they came up with that number, okay, the $100 billion. This is well documented about how we did this, and if you're interested in going into the methodology, it's in the appendix of the report. Days work missed, which is productivity lost, is 11.6 to 12.7 billion. Hours work lost, 95.2 to 96.5 billion dollars. Lower wages, because people who may not be able to work full time, for instance, 190.6 to 226.3 billion. And that gives you sort of a range. Truth is somewhere within that range. And the incremental cost of healthcare is $261 to $300 billion. Now again, remember those caveats that I said at the very beginning. This doesn't include military, doesn't include people in long-term care, prisons, doesn't include kids. These are only adults, okay? And that's based on that limited definition of chronic pain. So barriers to effective, that's you, right? Yes, okay. We're going back and forth to make sure we have the content expert.
There are many barriers to effective pain care, and I want to go briefly over them, and it's actually quite depressing to see if you think about these barriers, and it will take some time to overcome them, and we made in the report specific recommendations and timelines how to overcome these barriers. Barriers on the system level, those are institutional. For example, a lot of hospitals don't have a pain treatment center or physicians and other healthcare providers specifically seeing pain patients, so the patients have no place to go. Then there are educational barriers. Pain is not a subspecialty, and education is lacking at many different levels. It starts already at the medical school level. In the report, you will find the data for it in during the four-year medical school curriculum here in the United States. The medical students have, on average, only 9 lectures on pain. So you can imagine, as they go then into clinical practice during their residency, that they are not very well educated and cannot help the patients very well. They might even be scared to hear about pain because they don't know what to do about it. There are organizational barriers. This is, again, due to the fact that there is no specialty that is just there to treat pain patients. So physicians from many different specialties, nurses, other healthcare providers, they all see the patients, also the psychologists, but we don't have really a healthcare organization where all these healthcare providers can get together and get some guidance. We have some organizations such as the American Pain Society or the International Association for the Study of Pain, where scientists and healthcare providers can get together, and they have attempted over the last years and are moving forward to provide guidelines. There are reimbursement related issues, and I will discuss this further, both for the clinician level as well as the patient level. On the clinician level, barriers are due to the fact that evidence-based guidelines on assessment and treatment of pain are lacking, and this is partly due to the fact that this is a fairly new specialty, subspecialty within medicine, but the different organizations, the American Pain Society, the gynecological, urological, orthopedic organizations are moving forward now with providing guidelines which will help primary physicians as well as specialists to treat patients. There needs to be adequate pain education at the medical school level, as I already mentioned, at the residency level for the different subspecialties, psychologists, nurses, and so on, and this is currently not in place. Clinicians need to collaborate and actually need to have a forum to collaborate. The IOM report recommends that uncomplicated pain patients are seen by the primary care physician, whereas the very complex chronic pain patients are seen in specialized centers, and that there is a good collaboration between the pain centers and the primary care physicians. And a forum for that is currently not available. And even at pain centers, there's often not an avenue available where people with different subspecialties, the nurses and the psychologists, can actually work together. There need to be policies on appropriate use of opioids, and there needs to be insurance coverage so that clinicians who see pain patients can actually reimburse. The very complex pain patients are often very time consuming because it's a long history, they have more than one pain syndrome, and so the physician who treats that patient, the primary physician or the pain specialist, typically not only has to spend a lot of time with the patient himself or herself, but also has to find the time to communicate with the other specialists who are seeing that patient. And for that, there's currently very little insurance coverage. There are a lot of patient-level barriers. We addressed awareness of pain. A lot of patients are not even aware that their pain can be treated. They don't know where to go. If they are interested to find a pain clinician, because in a lot of rural areas, for example, they have to drive a long way to get treatment, and often their mobility might be impaired, so then it becomes a downward spiral. Insurance coverage is a great problem. Patients with chronic pain, similar to patients with cancer or other chronic diseases such as diabetes, these patients need to see the healthcare provider repeatedly, and often the insurance is not able to cover that, or the patient might have repeated co-payments, which then prevent the patient to actually see the healthcare provider at the intervals required. And although there is growing evidence that in the biopsychosocial model for a pain treatment, that psychological treatments and also physical therapy are helpful for reducing pain, in addition to nerve blocks, medical pain management, and invasive procedures, often there is not sufficient coverage, although a patient might be insured, because those are repeated healthcare provider patient interactions, such as psychological treatment, physical therapy. Those require repeated interactions. And as you, the data when we published the IOM report were that 19% of the American population under the age of 65 has no insurance at all, and 14% are underinsured. So if somebody like that has chronic pain, then it is really very difficult to find care, and this needs to be changed. And the committee also addressed that on the patient level, so not only on the clinician level, but also on the patient level, there are often concerns about opioid use and addiction, and education in this regard is needed. I want to now go through some of the recommendations from the IOM report, and I hope as you come from different fields in public health that you might be able to find a few aspects where you actually think you can move this field forward. Healthcare provider organizations should promote and enable self-management of pain as a starting point of management. We suggested to develop educational approaches and culturally and linguistically appropriate materials to promote and enable self-management. And what would that mean? There are lots of things that patients can do themselves. Obesity might contribute to back pain, so a program to lose weight might help a back pain patient. There are relaxation techniques that patients can do themselves. A lot of physical therapy or exercises can be continued by the patient themselves. That does not need to be in a clinical office or in a physical therapy office. But patients need to have the tools to actually do this self-management. Population strategy described in the other recommendations that Olivia will discuss should include developing strategies to overcome barriers to care. And strategies should focus on ways to improve care for populations disproportionately affected by and undertreated for pain. And as Olivia mentioned before, some of those are people in rural areas, mentally impaired patients, palliative care patients, and so on. She had a whole list of this, so I don't want to go over it again, but there are a lot of opportunities actually, depending in which field of public health you are, you might see new opportunities to implement this recommendation. Health professions, education and training programs, professional associations, and other groups should provide educational opportunities in pain assessment and treatment in primary care. Education should improve knowledge and skills in pain assessment and treatment. Patients who have chronic pain typically see the primary care physician first, and those physicians often do not have the education to actually help the patients. But significant improvement could actually come from good interactions and good collaborations between primary care physicians and pain treatment centers. And in order to facilitate that, education needs to be improved so that the primary care physician is not scared of a patient with chronic pain, but knows what to do and also knows when to refer the patient to a pain treatment center. Pain specialty professional organizations and primary care professional associations should support collaboration between specialists and primary care clinicians, including greater proficiency by primary care providers, along with referral to pain centers when appropriate. Payers and healthcare organizations should revise reimbursement policies to foster coordinated and evidence-based pain care. As I said before, currently this is not in place because the reimbursement policies do not really allow chronically sick patients, not only pain patients, but also other patients, to use the health system repeatedly, and the time of the healthcare team is often limited to address the very complicated issues of these patients. Healthcare providers should provide consistent and complete pain assessment, so they need to have enough time to take a history, which is often quite complex in a patient who had already pain for years, has seen a lot of different physicians, has tried a lot of different things, and currently there's no system in place where such a patient can actually have a very comprehensive evaluation except at very few centers. Federal agencies and other stakeholders should expand and redesign education programs to transform the understanding of pain. And these entities should develop education programs for patients, the public, and healthcare providers. So it will require a totally improved education for all three entities. CMS and HRSA accrediting organizations and undergraduate and graduate health professions training programs should improve curriculum and education for healthcare professionals at all levels. Education programs for health professionals should increase the number of health professionals with advanced expertise in pain care. At the moment, there is a very small number of people who are actually trained in pain management who is available for this large group of patients who have chronic pain in America. The next set of recommendations is directed to increase research. We recommended that the NIH should designate a lead institute within the NIH responsible for moving pain research forward and increase support for and scope of the pain consortium. At the moment, as you know, there is no pain institute, so there is no place where, for example, grants for pain can be directed to. But there is a pain consortium, so a number of NIH institutes for several years already have provided a forum where they have meetings about pain and where there are common interactions. And we recommended that the lead institute should include pain as a central part of its mission, assume leadership of that pain consortium, which consists of leaders of several NIH institutes, assess the effectiveness of the NIH in moving pain research forward and identify funding needs. And the pain consortium, and the plus here is really that this already exists, should hold more frequent, regular, structured, and productive meetings, improve process for reviewing grant proposals related to pain, work with pain advocacy groups to help identify public need related to treatment and management, and improve and expand public-private partnerships. Academia and industry should improve the process for developing new agents for pain control. Federal agencies and private funders of pain research should increase support for interdisciplinary research in pain. Public and private funders should increase the conduct of longitudinal research in pain, because we don't know what the natural history of pain is from childhood to old age. And with support of the NIH, academic institutions should be able to increase the training of pain research for the future. Now, Olivia. Okay.
So now I'm going to address public health approaches to address pain. Now, we had talked before of the huge dollar amount that chronic pain is costing the United States. We also saw trends that seem to be reflecting that the prevalence of pain is going up over time from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. If you look at state-specific estimates, for the few states that do have these data, it also suggests that the prevalence is increasing. Well, the prevalence is increasing for several reasons, and we see that it will continue to increase for these same reasons. We are getting heavier, and those who are getting heavier are at higher risk of having joint-related injuries. We also are getting older, and so as an aging population, we're going to be more likely to have pain-related conditions such as arthritis. That anyone who embarks on surgery is at risk of developing either acute pain or having that acute pain transition into chronic pain. We're being much more successful in saving lives for individuals who have suffered catastrophic injuries. And so these are individuals who may then continue with chronic pain. And so for these reasons, we've got an increasing need to better address prevention. And we're going to give you some examples fairly soon on population-based prevention initiatives that have been started here in the United States and also elsewhere, and some ideas about potential savings of these public health approaches. So the importance of prevention: if we can prevent chronic disease, if we can keep a healthy weight, for instance, we'll hopefully be able to reduce, or at least at best maintain that rate that we currently have. But specific prevention approaches could include conditions and work environments. Those who are interested in occupational safety and health would be interested in this. Use of safety equipment to reduce sports injuries, developing community understanding of the nature of pain, working together with organizations, professionals, and individuals to protect health, and involving people from multiple sectors. And some of the examples where they have been successful in doing this are prescription drug take-back programs, for instance, that we have here in the United States. The intention is to reduce misuse and abuse of prescription pain medications. A surprisingly high percentage of young adults who are misusing these pain medications are accessing them from family members who had a prescription that perhaps they haven't completely used. Maybe it's in a cabinet or something. They're not even realizing that the young adult is accessing them. So prescription drug take-back programs is one way to reduce that misuse and abuse of the prescription pain medications. Campaigns to reduce back pain disability. We found some really encouraging literature, for instance, in Australia, where they had a $10 million three-year program, Don't Take It Lying Down, where they had several simple messages. Back pain is not necessarily a serious condition, that disability from back pain can be improved. Stay working. In other words, don't think because you're experiencing back pain that this is a reason to stay home. Stay continue to work, and there's a lot that you can do for self-care to address back pain. What they found when they followed these individuals over time is that overall in the community, back injury claims dropped by 15%. They found it very cost-effective. So some other countries then embarked on similar campaigns, but at a smaller scale, Scotland, Norway, and Canada. And some of them haven't been quite as effective, and they think it's because it hasn't been at the level that they were doing it in Australia. But it gives us an insight as to what we potentially can do, and this is just focusing on low back pain. So potential savings from a public health program approach. What can we do to better treat acute pain so it doesn't transition into chronic pain? How can we reduce health problems and complications of other physical and mental diseases and conditions? How can we reduce our public and private sector economic costs? Perhaps by adding the psychosocial component to the medical treatment that currently is being offered. How can we prevent the costly effects of pain? What is the most cost-effective care for people with chronic pain? How can we reduce the burden of opioid misuse and abuse? And there's a tension between that. How can we better care for those who have chronic pain, and how can we reduce that burden of opioid misuse and abuse? And better tailor treatment to individuals. So recommendations that the committee made in regards to public health is that there are particular federal agencies who have a responsibility for collection and reporting of data. So we've named the ones in particular, National Center for Statistics, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, but there are other federal and state agencies that also are involved in collection and reporting of health data. So we want to improve the collection of these data in terms of incidence and prevalence, new cases and existing cases, costs of pain and pain care, effectiveness of treatment, interference with activities of daily living, and the use of clinical and social services. We would like the Secretary to embark on a comprehensive population-level strategy, a strategy that addresses pain prevention, treatment, management, and research, and that will better coordinate efforts across the public and private sector. In particular, we would like to have better resource the National Institutes of Health Pain Consortium and reaching out to private sector participants as appropriate. And a need to involve the public, enhancing public awareness of chronic pain and what you can do to prevent it. So a blueprint for transforming pain prevention care education and research is proposed, and we set a timeline, 2012, before the end of 2012. Here we're getting towards the end of 2011, so we really need to get going. That's part of the reason why we're here today. We want that comprehensive blueprint to include strategies for reducing barriers to pain care, support collaboration between pain specialists and primary care clinicians, and to designate a lead institute at NIH. Right now it's a consortium, and it's not clear who's leading it. And part of the reason why it hasn't really been able to be as effective is because there isn't someone who really is responsible for this and that will be able to target and track what's being done. By 2015, we would like to have, as part of this blueprint, improving the collection and reporting of data, promote and enable self-management of care of pain, provide educational opportunities in pain assessment and treatment in primary care, revise reimbursement policies to foster coordinating evidence-based pain care, and provide consistent and complete pain assessments. Also expand and redesign education programs to transform the understanding of pain, improve curriculum and education for the healthcare professionals, increase the number of health professionals who have that advanced expertise in pain care, improve the process for developing new agents for pain control, increase support for interdisciplinary research as well as longitudinal research, and increase the training of pain researchers. So I'm transitioning now. I wish I had a hat on because then I could take it off. I'm transitioning. I'm a former member of the Executive Board of the American Public Health Association, longtime member of the American Public Health Association, over 30 years, and current member of the Education Board. So I'm going to remind you of the strategic plan. So here I'm not talking anymore as a member of the committee. So officially I'm talking as an APHA member. Here's the strategic map for APHA. Okay, it says that APHA wants to be the go-to organization for public health. Our priorities is that we want to improve the impact of policy and advocacy, provide service to members in the profession to build capacity, use strategic communications to frame issues and increase impact, and implement a sustainable business model. Overall, we want to create, implement, and assess the engagement strategy required for future success of being the go-to organization for public health, recognizing that the number of people who are impacted by chronic pain and the dollars that are spent to treat lost productivity, etc., for pain. And that's, you saw all the caveats. That doesn't even include the personal caregivers. It doesn't include the kids. It doesn't include those in the military. It doesn't include those who are in the civilians, who are non-civilian in prisons and long-term care. It doesn't include those individuals. I'm talking serious impact. What can we do as an organization? Our priorities fit in really well, we think, in terms of this report and its recommendations, because we want to rebuild the public health infrastructure, ensure access to health care, and eliminate health disparities. So your input is needed. Specifically in these areas, how can we improve data collection reporting on data for longitudinal data, training of pain researchers, standardization of how we ask the questions? How can we enhance public awareness of nature of pain, chronic pain prevention, and role of self-care? How can we, as an organization, as members, as public health workers, how can we improve pain assessment and management within the federally funded service delivery and financing programs? Where do we start? Who should be included? So now I'm looking to you. I'm hoping to get input. I'm going to first ask another question. How many of you are members of APHA? If you could just raise your hand. Okay, and just out of curiosity, which sections or caucuses or SPIGs are represented here? I'm just curious. This is supported by epidemiology, but I'm just curious. We can start in, over here on the right.
Injury.
Your injury, great.
Aging and public health.
Aging and public health. Anybody else?
Epi.
Epi, great. Another epidemiologist, great. Anybody else? Oh, complementary internal practices, okay. Anybody else? I'm sorry? Medical care, great.
Aging.
Aging, another aging person.
HIV, AIDS, and Women's Caucus.
Oh, great. Women's Caucus, HIV, AIDS. Anybody else? Anybody? Huh?
Maternal
health. Awesome. Okay. Anybody else?
Health education.
Health education, great.
Mental health.
Mental health? Oh, awesome. This is the kind of interdisciplinary work we need. It's like we got a little coalition here. I don't hear oral health. I didn't hear oral health. We're missing oral health. Yeah, I guess nobody no oral health professionals today. But where do we start? Who should be included? What was new from the report that we just shared with you today? Do you have any questions?
Oh, I'd like to give a copy of the presentation.
Yes, and we've been unsuccessful. Adrienne's been working very hard trying to get uploaded, and it might be the size of the file. So she's going to try to break it up into three and see if that works. And if it doesn't, we've got pieces of paper. If you can grab a piece of paper and give us your email address, we can notify you when we've been successful in uploading it. Because we're afraid that if it's an issue with the size, that also your email address may not accept it.
I work in corrections, and I actually see patients in pain clinics that get referred to me on pharmacist by background, and I get referred to them by my physician and my local providers to see patients in pain. And one of the things as I look in the data, because I'm also working on my PhD with an emphasis in pain, is there isn't any statistics in prison. And I get the people that I have there are, maybe not your typical patient because they've been shot 27 times, they have injuries that the typical overweight 55-year-old diabetic with peripheral neuropathy doesn't have because they've gotten stuck from their previous environment. So I'm really curious how to go about either getting some of that data, or being the person that develops and publishes.
It sounds like you may need to be part of that group that develops and publishes on it. What we're hoping, as you can see, we had some specific recommendations for NIH. What we're hoping is that NIH will respond with more interest in funding this kind of research. They do have an announcement that we had seen, a general announcement, saying they are interested in pain-related research, and it came out of the Pain Consortium. But there may be a need for you, and part of this is we need to standardize questions, and so you can easily compare with national data with your own population.
And the other thing that I see now, granted, this, in corrections, we get very narrow, but it does still bring in some of the aspects that I see in the community, and that is my providers are not fully educated on pain management. certain things like knee replacements, but other things on the spine we can't do or we won't do in our environment. The third thing that I see is the, oh my God, it's an opioid, oh my God, we're going to give an opioid to somebody that's in prison. And they're so afraid of addiction, selling, you know, all of that stuff that, again, why physicians on the outside are like hesitant to treat with drugs that are very effective.
One of the questions that I'd like to raise before people run out the door, we've got forums at the front, so if you have any suggestions of who we should be talking to, you know, to communicate the results, if you have organizations, entities, people in particular you think we should be communicating to, please write it down, because we're in the dissemination phase right now. We really need that input. So it may be some of the folks you're interacting with will be part that we want to disseminate. Now, somebody had a hand over here on the right, another hand. I'm sorry. So, somebody had a hand up? One of the things we found out that, to me as an epidemiologist, I found very interesting is the placebo effect. And we have an entire discussion about the placebo effect, because it makes it very challenging to assess how effective a particular pain treatment is, because the placebo effect also is very significant. So it may be that just the interaction by being part of the research process, you're kind of like somebody's validating that you're in pain, and that sort of positive, in a way, positive feedback is making that person feel better just with that. So there's a whole section in the report on placebo effect that you might be interested in. Yeah. There's a couple of my hands over here on the left. Yes. Actually, we had a lot of discussion about it, and I'd like to bring Ursula up, because in some cases it is a separate entity, and I'd like to have Ursula, if she can come up and talk about it.
Yeah, that's why we recommended a biopsychosocial approach to actually address all these aspects, because it's not only the pain symptom, but everything else that goes with it, including, as I said earlier, if a patient is depressed, angry, and anxious, this also has an effect on the surroundings of the patient, and so the social interactions are changed. And all of this needs to be addressed in the treatment approach. And we discussed also in the committee report whether there should be a trend to actually recognize pain as a disease entity. You seem to be not so much in favor of that, but that is one route that has been recommended, because currently in the WHO definitions, pain is not listed as a disease. That might be one of the effects of it as far as insurance issues are concerned, but it also would reflect the thinking about pain, that it's really a multimodal, multifactorial disease that needs to be addressed from all aspects, as I said, this biopsychosocial approach, so it would give a name to the complexity of pain.
The gentleman over here with the blue tie. Yes, I can't see your badge. The international comparative studies is the age-adjusted rate of 37% of adults have chronic pain. And it sounds like perhaps some of the messages that are discussed in the report, for instance, from the low back pain campaigns that I was mentioning, some of them may be useful for testing. Your estimate is really right on the money with what we found with the international comparison. And the cost estimates, I forgot to mention, those cost estimates do not include the over-the-counter drugs, because a lot of people take over-the-counter Advil, Tylenol, you know, et cetera, aspirin. So it doesn't even include that. So that's like an additional cost on top of that.
Being a physician too, I'm always
we had a really short period of time to put this report together, but as you heard from Adrian, we had over 2,000 comments. We had several public hearings. We had a wonderful expertise that was on our panel. So we have both unpublished and published data that are included in the report. We also have sort of the latest in the research thinking about what causes pain, what are the pathways, and how to best treat it. It isn't like if you want to figure out how to treat pain, this is the go-to, but hopefully it kind of outlines what the framework is for us going forward. There's a hand, the gentleman in the back. Yes, you had your hand up. I'm going to bring Ursula up because she can better speak at that incorporating the biopsychosocial approach to pain management and treatment.
And that's why it's important to your point regarding all the comorbidities, regarding, for instance, the psychological comorbidities. So as a pain physician, if I prescribe a pain medication, say nortriptyline, to a patient, but the patient is so depressed that even although nortriptyline can also be used as an antidepressant, might not even come for the next doctor's appointment, then we can't make any gain together, the patient and myself, for a better pain treatment. And that's why it's important that this biopsychosocial model, which has been tested in a number of settings, is really applied. But in order for it to be applied, at the same time, the insurance issues need to be addressed, because the physician, if the psychologist cannot see the pain patient because the psychologist in the pain clinic is not getting reimbursed, then we don't make any progress. And then it becomes actually quite expensive, because this chronic pain patient moves on to have chronic pain, doesn't get adequate treatment, and might over time perhaps even develop more comorbidities and become then very complex.
Thank you. One example we also heard in our extensive discussions that in some cases opiates really are not the preferred method of treatment. I think it was for migraine or it was something like that. We had a discussion.
Yeah, there's a lot of research
right.
Still going on for which
about the best treatments. Yeah. What's the best treatment?
Not only for opioids, but for a lot of different treatments. What is the ideal patient for a given treatment, or vice versa, what treatment should be given to an individual patient. So it's similar discussions as we have in oncology to individualize the treatment.
So that research is also still needed. Now, one of the things that American Public Health Association does is put out public policy. And so we took a look at the policies that were on the books, and really they don't address pain. So some of you who feel so passionate, I would suggest that perhaps you can get together with other folks in your sections, etc., to develop a policy that can be submitted through the policy process next year to have the American Public Health Association come out with strong statements about some of these very important issues that you're bringing up. You had a comment.
I just wanted to address that who should be included on improved data collection and enhanced public awareness. So colleges and universities have a survey they do every year, and I've been successful in putting on questions of chronic pain, giving them the issue of chronic pain and the impact on their studies. And it was extremely interesting, the results coming back. And so I think if this could be done, you know, throughout the United States, to get the colleges and universities to put this on their national survey every year, that'll help on data collection there. And as far as public awareness, is once I know on my campus, once I brought this data, we were able to get an initiative from our university to bring out more public awareness of what to do with managing pain for students.
It sounds like something in the epi section. We should get together with you after the session. Thank you. I thought I saw another hand. Yes. If you go to the Oxford University Press booth, there is a chronic pain epidemiology text that came out this past year. They have an entire chapter on low back pain and the development of these standardized questions. They work with several countries to come up with a standardized set of questions. That kind of very, you know, thorough process in developing and testing questions, that's what we would like to see, because then you can have these comparisons not only within the United States, but also these international comparisons. Are we seeing these increases in prevalence, not only in the United States, but elsewhere too? This whole definition about, you know, not just during the past month, but to be able to distinguish, because they... National Center for Statistics typically asks about during the past month, but then you can't distinguish between acute and chronic pain. You need to take it to, you know, how long has that pain lasted to be able to make that distinction.